I still want to primarily write about working class black people.
Okay.
But not just the poverty, porn, and the tragedy. I want to write about beauty and culture from that lens.
From that lens.
If that makes sense.
That 100% makes sense to me. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Am I Allowed to Like Anything, the podcast that talks to people about their work, their lives, how they're maintaining their optimism in this world, and what they are currently loving in culture right now versus all the things we know we hate. I'm your host, Darian Harvin, and this week, Jasmine Sanders joins me on the podcast. Jasmine is a writer at Jezebel. She's also written for the New York Times, BuzzFeed News, Catapult, and New York Magazine. I love this conversation I have with Jasmine because she really shows that she's not afraid to vocalize her thoughts and opinions, not just on the internet, but in real life. And I know that this may seem like such an obvious trait, but it is not. And I really appreciate Jasmine for that and for her not being afraid to say how she feels, not just online, but in conversation, right? So we talk about her journey of becoming a better writer. And of course, as it's becoming more frequent on this podcast, skincare. I talked to Jasmine about the aesthetics of beauty she grew up admiring and the products that she's using today. Remember to follow Am I Allowed to Like Anything on Instagram or Twitter, whichever is your jam. I'll put the links in this episode's description. And to follow me on Instagram at Darian. It's just my name. And lastly, if you love this episode, subscribe. If you're already here, you might as well subscribe. You might as well even think about leaving a review. You might as well just become a part of the Am I Allowed to Like Anything family. I definitely have been watching a lot of Jackie Aina on YouTube because I basically just feel like I did a whole campaign around subscribing to my podcast the way that she does around her YouTube channel, and I feel no shame. All right, let's get into this. We're here.
Yes. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I feel like we were talking about such interesting things before we started, but now we're here.
Hello.
And tell me again how long you've been living in Brooklyn, in New York.
I moved to New York March 21st.
I love how you remember.
Yeah, I remember. It's like I had to pay like prorated rent.
Right.
So
that'll make you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're coming from Chicago, where you were born and raised?
Yes, South Side.
So, you know, the question I always start off by asking people on Am I Allowed to Like Anything is, talk to me about how you grew up. Talk to me about what life was like for you. And start wherever you would like. There's not a right or wrong place to start.
Okay. So I grew up on the South Side of Chicago in a neighborhood that's called Bronzeville. Famously, its most famous denizen would be Gwendolyn Brooks. The part of Bronzeville that I lived in was the Robert Taylor Housing Projects, which was sort of a high-rise settlement built on the South Side in response to huge swaths of black people, black working class people coming to Chicago during the Great Migration and requiring more what the city thought then was more adequate housing as opposed to the slums that had sort of arisen on the South Side at that time. But so I grew up on the South Side. I was raised by my grandmother, who was a woman from Arkansas, from a tiny town called Holly Grove, Arkansas. And so I grew up
raised by a grandmother, but my mother was kind of a satellite figure, in and out. Mm-hmm. She wasn't completely absent by any means. And I grew up with, I have two sisters and three brothers. Okay. So I grew up closest to my sisters, especially my younger sister, who's like, we're barely 2 years apart, mm-hmm. very, very close in age. And
are you the oldest?
No, I'm a middle. I'm,
you're middle?
I'm a middle sister. I have an older sister and a younger sister.
Okay.
And just very middle child-esque, like quintessential.
You're like a quintessential middle child. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I remember there was a tweet in which you were talking about where you went to school growing up. Mm-hmm. And I felt like you had mentioned that it was like a Black-centric school. Like, it was a school founded.
Yeah.
Is that true? Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. So I went to a school that was, so you live in a housing project, right? And Chicago's hyper segregated. Like, mm-hmm. have you ever been?
I've only been once, but I wasn't there long enough to really, really explore.
For sure. Mm-hmm. People who visit Chicago are always struck by how segregated it is. Mm. So the housing project I lived in was completely Black. And so the school was completely Black. Like, mm-hmm. my teachers were Black. All of my classmates were Black. And also my neighbors, you know. So these people you live with and see in that capacity and then see at school and mm-hmm. then see after school. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a different relationship.
Yes.
So I have so many, I have almost all of my friends from grammar school, and I don't have any high school friends.
Why not?
So the school I went to was a very small, technically underperforming school. Mm-hmm. My graduating eighth grade class was maybe 14 people, and it was very pseudo Black nationalist, Black Panther mm-hmm. type of fake militancy deal. Uh-huh. Also, Chicago has a really significant population of Black Muslims.
Okay.
So that influenced, like, I had a lot of Black Muslim teachers.
Okay.
So, yeah, just, I don't think it was officially a part of the school credo, but just the Black women teachers I had. And
I
also
understand.
that moment in time, like in the 90s and early mm-hmm. 2000s, where these Black women had this an excess of Black women authors they were reading mm-hmm. and movies, romantic comedies. So I had my like third and fifth grade teachers were reading Toni Morrison to us. Like, they would read it to us before we read the books.
To yourselves.
Or Richard Wright. I was introduced to really, really young. So it was. My grammar school was definitely a baby Black nationalist movement, but unofficially.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I feel like what you're telling me is that it was less like your grandmother was like, you're going to go to this specific school where you're going to learn about your heritage, mm-hmm. and more of like, no, this was my environment and my community.
Yeah, for sure. And also the school is across the street,
okay.
right? So it's an older woman, and none of the schools in that area were that great. Mm-hmm. So you just go to the one that's most convenient, that's right across the street.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I remember having teachers who, in, like, the early 2000s were going natural. Like, they were cutting their hair off and, like, growing dreads and growing their hair in natural. And that was, mm-hmm. like, the first time I remember being like, I'm not perming my hair because my teacher isn't perming hers and we're reading Sula.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm not doing it either.
Yeah.
So there's a quote I had sent to you, and it was specifically in an article you had written for BuzzFeed and really stood out to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to read it for the podcast.
Yes.
And it says, I didn't learn whiteness as a default or the limitations placed on those who existed outside of it until I was much, much older.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to talk to you about that in conjunction with your upbringing or mm-hmm. even like how you view the world now. Because, yeah. I mean, this is the first time we're meeting in real life, but
yes.
my perception, I guess, of you in how you speak mm-hmm. out in the world and even how you write, whether it's through your writing or something that's published or even if it's on social media,
mm-hmm.
is that there is
a lack of hesitancy that you speak with.
Yes.
And so when I read that quote, I was like, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like there aren't a lot of us who, maybe there are, but I guess I'm just speaking for myself, is mm-hmm. not a lot of us grow up in that way of feeling what some people may say is entitlement,
mm-hmm.
but it's really growing up believing what we deserve, right?
Mm-hmm.
From where we live to how we're treated by others,
mm-hmm.
To how we view ourselves.
Yes.
So anyways, I just wanted to know more about kind of like that sentence because it really stuck out to me.
Yeah, I think what I was getting at and understand or trying to communicate in that essay was that growing up in an environment that's completely Black, obviously inequality manifests in other ways.
Yeah.
So one of the first otherisms or prejudices I was aware of was colorism and gender. And even amongst working class people, there's different levels and there's people who are doing better than others and
right.
others, while some are doing worse. So I think that quote was me attempting to articulate a stance and a politic for how I understood myself as a little girl and a little bit as an adult too. And also the thing with growing up in, I feel like I'm really sporadic, which is something I'm trying to rein in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also because I'm not confrontational, but I'm not, like, I would rather have the confrontation and then just be done with it. Because it's like, you grow up around all Black people, you know that all of you don't like each other.
Right.
You know, like, right. you know that you don't like some people and it's fine. Or
right.
you may have
versus
a disagreement.
Versus, like, peace and love between all of us, right?
Yeah,
it's,
no.
It's like just like every other human, right? Like, there's conflict.
Yeah, we always had
differences.
Yeah, so I never thought that having or disagreements or conflict in those ways were super detrimental or trenchant in
yes.
the way that I think I'm realizing that they are.
Yes.
They may be now.
Yes,
if that
I understand
makes, I
that.
That makes sense.
It's almost like being in a workplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And saying how you feel.
Yes.
And someone comes back to you and says, I think you should tone that down.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't say that to the man in the room. Like, we run into these conversations, but then there's like, but learning that when you kind of have been taught to be clear and to
mm-hmm.
say how you feel and to confront and to speak,
yes.
and to speak to people,
mm-hmm.
I totally understand that. I feel like I'm on the reverse side where I'm learning how to be more transparent and
mm-hmm.
more clear, but the process has actually been like kind of therapeutic in a way.
Yeah. I'm working on the opposite. I'm trying to be like way less transparent and more thoughtful in what I speak and post on social media. Not in a way that I want to completely mute myself,
mm-hmm.
but I just feel like a mindfulness is something that I could practice.
You
more
could practice more. I understand that
down
element
between like what I think and what I say.
I see.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I do feel like you say what you mean very, very, very clearly. So if that counts for anything.
Thanks.
I was listening to another podcast that you did in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and you had talked about how you, it was 2 years ago, but
yes.
you had talked about how you, not how you started writing, but how you were a new writer,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I was curious to know, where did you go to college, like what your major was? Did that affect kind of what you did after graduation? Like, what were you doing before you started writing?
So I went to grammar school, and then I tested into a magnet school, so a really good high school
okay.
that had kind of restarted. But the thing was, I was like away from my friends. So at that time, we moved away from the housing projects from Robert Taylor because they were being demolished. So we switched neighborhoods while I was attending, like becoming a high school
mm-hmm.
freshman. And I just couldn't do it. It was a complete, probably the experience people describe going away to college I had as a high school freshman. And seeing Black people who were completely not like me and from a different socioeconomic background and completely different just personas and the ways that like I say it jokingly, but that middle class politesse.
Yes.
Just a politeness that right. you learn as a person. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was a huge culture shock and just very cloying to me. Mm. So I went through high school. I got really good grades in high school for a while. And then junior year, I just kind of let it all go. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, I'm actually just going to not do this. Yeah. And I kind of just essentially stopped going to school in any real way. Like, this is what I would do. All of my friends went to another high school, High Park Career Academy, which was just like a club in the shape of a schoolhouse. Like, it was just a good time.
Yeah.
So I used to, if I went to, I would go to school with my friends at High Park. So I would spend like half the day there and then go to my actual high school okay. later in the day.
Wow, you were doing your, you were like, this is how I'm living my life, basically.
Yeah, so like, yeah. Or like one time, my mom, I was like living with my mom then because she lived closer to school. And I remember leaving out. And so I would like leave out of my house and then my mom would leave out after me because she was going to work. Mm-hmm. And after she left out, I would go back home and like change clothes, meet my friends, get my plans together to go to the other school.
Yeah.
And one day she met me, like she caught me. So I'm like walking back to my house and my mom's like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, what are you doing here? And she's like, what is this? Or I remember one time I was just reckless and egregious in a way that's really funny now. But I remember one day there was, do you remember how much we loved the Victoria's Secret scents?
Yes.
And it was one of those ridiculous sales where it was something like 7 perfumes for $30.
Right.
And
I'm blanking so, on the name that the name of
Sweet
the one I love.
Pea,
so,
Love Sweet Spell. Pea,
Love Spell.
All of those, like, it's alcohol. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just,
it's like,
whatever. But
don't spray it on your body, basically.
Yes. But so my friends and I decided that we were going to go shopping for the first half of the day
mm-hmm.
and then show up to school mm-hmm. around like lunch hour.
Okay.
And so I would just do things like that. Like,
I see.
School was kind of like a part-time job I hated or mm-hmm. just showed up to. So I actually, all of that to say that I didn't go to college.
Like, okay.
I didn't graduate high school. I like didn't have enough credits to graduate. And so I was supposed to be, what my mother wanted was for me to be a fifth-year senior. So, and that was the plan. I was mm-hmm. like, okay, I can do this. I'm going to do one more year
mm-hmm.
and then I'll have my high school diploma and go to college. And my test scores were really good mm-hmm. at that time. Like, I got a really good ACT score. But I go to the school, walk there, go into the office, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm not going to do this.
I can't do this.
I'm not doing this. Mm-hmm. So I eventually just, like, got a high school equivalency, like a GED.
And
I've been in and out of college, kind of flirting with the idea, but mm-hmm. never committedly.
It has been, I feel like
I know that was really.
No, no, but how many people know that about you, do you feel?
I feel like I broadcast it almost obnoxiously. At this point. So I feel like it's a part of, I don't know if it's a part of my mythos. It definitely is in my head, mm-hmm. but I don't know if other people are as aware of it as I am.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's ever affected you in terms of with writing, with any other kind of career?
With writing, I think sometimes with regard to access and also just my ability to write,
mm-hmm.
to form a thesis and write mm-hmm. an essay around that and communicate my ideas. And also, again, access and resources. Yes.
Okay.
Do
you ever feel like you missed out on anything?
Now, no, because everyone's yeah. dying with student debt.
Yeah, no, I was going to say.
Everyone's dying. My little sister did go, and my older sister and my family has just kind of turned out to be like my, you know, you have like all of those cousins and family mm-hmm. members your age. My generation of my family all went to college.
Went to college.
Now less so, and especially I feel like the internet is kind of a huge democratizing force in yes. that way. So, I mean, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
But at this point, it's less of a hindrance than I felt it was then.
Yeah, I definitely want to say, even from my standpoint, is that I sometimes when I hear that I have peers who have not gone to college, I am so happy for them to know that they don't have the kind of student loans that I have,
mm-hmm.
you know? And sometimes I feel excited that hopefully there are these new ways of gaining an education in whatever way you see mm-hmm. fit, right, to accomplish the things that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only is college not for everyone, mm-hmm. but it's also expensive. And this separation between, like, not-for-profit and for-profit colleges is, like, honestly, both options mm-hmm. aren't too great at this point financially. I always kind of feel like a Michelle Obama traitor because she always advocates going for college, but I really just don't agree with her.
Yeah, God bless her.
God bless her.
She also was a lawyer.
Yeah, went to Ivy League schools.
Yeah,
and
they love some black exceptionalism. God bless them.
God bless them.
Yeah.
So, with all that being said, what were you doing before you were writing? I know that you were serving. I only mentioned that because I used to serve.
Yeah, I was a server for a brief amount of time. I went to aesthetic school, so I got my license as an esthetician, and I did that for a little while, worked in a spa, and I worked in retail, including a pretty long stint in luxury retail, like higher-end retail.
Okay.
And for a while, I think my family thought that was like what it was going to be for me,
mm-hmm.
but I just have no disposition to like interact with the public in general,
mm-hmm.
much less in a service capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But of the service jobs I had, serving, waitressing and bartending were good, like good money. And
yeah.
I see it, especially in New York. I feel like I could be like a bartender here is like,
you can make really good money.
You can have a career.
Yeah.
Like as
and
a bartender.
A lot of them do.
Yeah. Yeah. Of the service jobs I had, I really liked being a barista.
Mm.
Like I really liked working in coffee shops. I was always a really cranky barista, but it worked for me, you know.
Yeah.
It's like Oscar the Grouch. People are like, oh, it's cute.
It's like a little like pseudo hipster, like just tell me what you want.
Yeah.
And then like making the coffee is therapeutic in itself.
Yeah, I really liked being a barista. So.
When did you decide that you were going to start writing more and you wanted to write for publications?
So in 2016, I decided that I wanted to go back to school.
Okay.
So I was taking a couple of classes that were mostly English and creative writing. Like I took an English class, a couple of English classes, and then a creative writing class. So I took a creative writing workshop, and I thought that it was the first time I'd considered being a writer, but I thought that I would be a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I take the class, and I recognize immediately that my fiction writing just isn't up to par. It's just not good. So what other avenues are there? Mm-hmm. My professor at the time suggested nonfiction as a means of strengthening my fiction writing. So voice and mm-hmm. perspective and also just the habit of writing, and fiction writing would be, or nonfiction writing would conceivably or mm-hmm. theoretically be easier than fiction writing.
Okay.
So I did that, and it felt a lot more natural to me than fiction writing. And so I started submitting things for publication. I started a Twitter at that time.
Okay.
So like 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
And I remember finding a bunch of my favorite writers or people whose writing I'd come across and enjoyed, and then followed who they followed.
Yeah.
So I came across editors who were putting out calls for pitches, and that was how essays, like the one you referenced earlier, were published.
I want to talk about your essay your reported piece that you did for the New York Times.
Yeah.
On essentially, I'm trying to think of how would you describe, Memorial t-shirts.
Yes.
Memorial t-shirts that were common in, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, but I grew up in the suburbs, like the outskirts, essentially, of Buffalo. But my grandmother had a soul food restaurant in the city, so I was always, like, in the city and there. And so I was just, like, familiar.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And there were always, you know, I was just familiar with that fashion and that style. And so talk to me about the process of, like, even thinking about that piece, pitching it to the New York Times. Like, how did it even get on the New York Times?
So that piece came out in November, I think it's October 2017. And so I started writing in 2016, and I knew nothing but personal essays. Mm-hmm. I wasn't as well-read as, like, I thought I was. And also, as a Black woman, it was just the avenue that I was very much pushed towards.
I see.
And there was, I felt like, a demand for
at that time, for sure.
Yeah, for the first-person narrative, the first-person industrial complex. First-person essay industrial complex. But which isn't to demean it in any way, because it's still a form that means a lot to me.
Yeah,
and that
me too.
Did a lot for me.
Mm-hmm.
But just the way that you have to navigate that economy as a Black woman, it's taxing. Looked at my pitches one day. I had a list of maybe 10 pitches, and it was essentially a compendium of all of my varied traumas. And I was just like, ooh. Maybe let's get away from this. So I decided I wanted to lean more towards journalism and criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I'd written a piece for Lenny Letter, which was kind of a hybrid form, a mix of some book criticism or literary criticism and, I guess, memoir/essay.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was what I wanted to do.
Okay.
So I published semi-regularly in 2016. And then in 2017, I didn't publish a lot because I felt like I needed to read and get better.
Mm-hmm.
So I took time off publishing to read and, like, write more that was not published.
Do you remember maybe a few of the books that you read that you can think of right now that were maybe really important to you at that time?
Yeah, I remember I'd known who Joan Didion was, but I hadn't had... Joan Didion wasn't incredibly close to me.
Okay.
So I'd read Slouching Towards Bethlehem and read all of her essays. I feel like in a certain way she's heavily remembered and heavily regarded as an essayist, but you get to the White Album and her later reporting, and she's an amazing reporter and journalist.
Mm-hmm.
So the White Album was foundational to me at that time.
Okay.
And then, of course, you find your idols, you read what they read. Mm-hmm. So by proxy of Didion, Ernest Hemingway, and also Rachel Kazi-Ganza, which wasn't a book, but her long-form pieces were very important to me. June Jordan, incredibly important to me. Hilton Owls, White Girls, and I don't think I loved White Girls until a little later, but The Women was very instructional.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I kind of just, I guess, tried with as much discipline as I could muster on my own, like outside of an academic setting, put myself through like a boot camp because I just felt like I wasn't good enough.
I often feel like I need to put myself through that boot camp now, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think that we end up being better for it.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Yeah.
I feel like a much stronger writer than I did. Like, I know I can be better. But I know, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
I have an idea of my own potential, but I also can recognize how much better I am now.
That's amazing. And, yeah.
Oh, thanks.
That's what it's about, in my opinion. Even as someone who, like, a lot of people will say, oh, like, what are you writing about? And I was like, if anyone pays attention, I haven't written anything in a long time, and I don't have a strong clippings of the things that I've written.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because I number one, realized for me how hard writing is, and also how much reading I had not done and how much reading I still have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I also got into a space where I was like, if I could be someone who's a news curator or a social media editor who is supporting
mm-hmm.
good writers,
yeah.
I would kind of like love to put myself into that space.
Yeah,
and like helping
sure.
them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I feel like I've been working on for a while. Anyway, yeah. So you put yourself through this like reading boot camp.
Yeah, and I published very little in 2017. And so the end of the year rolls around October, September, and I'm now in, I haven't frequently, but in a crisis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of I don't think people are going to remember me as a writer and feeling hyper aware of how long I could go without publishing,
mm-hmm.
which is such a millennial 21st century phenomena.
Yes.
I haven't written in 9 months. No one remembers that I'm
right.
a writer.
I was actually,
or I'm not a writer to myself.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, was there some point, I was honestly very, very impressed that you hadn't said yet, oh, I was going through this crisis of I hadn't written in a long time. Am I really a writer? Is anyone going to remember me? Am I actually relevant? You know, like
yeah.
these are all these moments that we have and little do we know is like we actually have time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways.
I agree. So I remember just being really downtrodden and crestfallen.
Mm-hmm.
So just on a lark saying, if I'm going to send out 5 pitches, or it was 3. It was 3 pitches to my 3 dream publications,
mm-hmm.
just like cold pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And if they all say no, or if they say yes, then I'll keep writing. And if they say no, it was kind of a coin toss.
Mm-hmm.
If they say no, I'm going to stop. If they say yes, I'll take it as fate that I should be a writer. And
mm-hmm.
this was coincidentally around the time that Hugh Hefner had died. So I was reading a lot of his, I was curious about the way that he would be memorialized. So I was reading a lot of the Hugh Hefner obituaries and commemorative, or I guess in memoriam pieces. And I came across a writer on the New York Times, Corey Sika, who I remember reading it and just being like, oh, like this is a really easy, fluid style of writing. I would
mm-hmm.
like to write like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to follow him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw he was an editor, so mm-hmm. he had his email in his bio.
Mm-hmm.
So I had pitched that the idea of a funerary piece, because I describe it a little bit in the essay, but I'd wanted it to be this behemoth document of that block, which is this collection of stores,
yes.
collection of franchises that are funerary businesses,
mm-hmm.
right? So the funeral home, the florist, the t-shirt shop.
Yeah. You mentioned the pamphlet shop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the place that prints out what I've always called obituaries,
mm-hmm.
but I guess it's like funeral programs.
Okay.
And so I'd pitched that a few places and got a bunch of no's, and then finally, someone at another magazine had said yes, and then he kind of ghosted me.
Mm.
So I, in a frenzy, this one day sent out a bunch of pitches, including one just very almost flippant, but I guess concise in hindsight,
mm-hmm.
one to the editor at the New York Times, and it got accepted. So that was my first reported piece, just by chance.
What I like and what I noticed, I think, midway through reading it, I remember reading it when it was first published, and then I was reading it again this morning, and something that you did that I took note of was how you talked about where you were from, you talked about the South Side of Chicago through the lens of memorial t-shirts in like funeral services,
mm-hmm.
without having to say the stats about death on the South Side,
mm-hmm.
or of gun violence on the South Side. Like,
yes.
It wasn't necessary for you to do or to say, because you were talking about what can be life on the South Side and what was
mm-hmm.
life on the South Side for many.
Yes.
And for...
Thank you.
Yeah, and so that's what I think I noticed about, there was like a nuance there, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, so I also didn't know what funeral proprietors, what is that how you say it, proprietors were, mm-hmm. before you had mentioned it in your piece.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It was also just a time where I'm not very active on Facebook, but it was just almost or a deluge of mm-hmm. gun-related deaths.
Yeah.
In my life and in my feed. And it started to make me feel, like, you start to feel a little bit crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So there was, because it's right after summer, mm-hmm. and there's always an uptick in gun violence over the summer. But I remember there was a period where my cousin's partner got shot. And then his friend also got shot. Mm-hmm. And then that friend's child died as a result of gun violence.
Wow.
And then someone I dated lost someone very close to them,
yeah.
who was also, like, close to me.
Mm-hmm.
And someone I went to grammar school with died. And another person I went to grammar school with got life in prison. And so it was just, like, all of this within maybe a 6-week period that, yeah, it just started to make me feel crazy. So mm-hmm. it felt like something I had to write about.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Tell me what you hope to do more of in terms of your writing, whether it's something that is about a book or specifically more topics that you want to write about. Like, what would be, like, your dream in terms of writing for right now?
I do want to write about film a lot more.
Okay.
I'm kind of in a similar space where I was in 2017, where I know that I want to write about this thing, and I know that I have some knowledge, but I also recognize that I need to read more, and I need to watch a lot more movies. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the dual answer to that. I'm also, I feel like I've found what I want my style to be. Like, I feel like the hybrid form
okay.
is, like, my home and what I want to get better at.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like Margot Jefferson or Hilton Owls, incredibly. So some people who meld those genres.
Yeah.
And also Rachel Kazyganza of memoir, essay, criticism, mm-hmm. journalism. I love doing that in a piece,
yeah.
and I want to continue to. So I want to continue. That's what I want as far as craft.
Mm-hmm.
Subjects, I still want to primarily write about working class Black people.
Okay.
But not just the poverty, porn, and the tragedy. I want to write about beauty and mm-hmm. culture from
yeah,
that lens.
From that lens.
If that makes sense.
That's 100% makes sense to
yes.
me. I want to talk about skincare.
Yeah, so let's talk about skincare.
I'm so ready to talk about skincare because
yes.
it
do
is
it. Talk about it.
The
are you
thing
what are you do?
I am
about.
Into right now.
Me too. Your skin looks great.
Your skin looks great.
Oh, thanks.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Two brown girls with gray skin.
Yes.
Tell me about I don't even know where to start. So with skincare, it's this thing that now is being associated with self-care in these times that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know, as Jasmine,
yes,
when have you always taken good care of your skin? Did you mm-hmm. did you grow up like your grandmother was? You need to wash your face every night, or
mm-hmm.
you have these rituals, or you know, tell me where you're at. Tell me where you're at in your journey.
So I was raised by an older Black woman, but surrounded by cousins and an older sister and a mother who were just incredibly glamorous women to me. And it was the 90s, so my sisters and my cousins were very, very hip-hop influenced. And the thing with living in public housing is it's so symbiotic where you don't have privacy, right? Like
mm-hmm.
everyone can hear everyone's music. You pass each other all the time. You see each other. Everyone hangs out outside. So it's hard to know like where something started versus where it ended up and
uh-huh.
who influences who. But you see everyone sort of following trends at the same time,
yeah.
the waves hitting at the same time,
right.
which is, I'm sure, true of any community, but when it's so concentrated, it's just hyper visible.
Right, and you notice it quicker. Probably.
Yeah, you notice it quicker. So I remember the moment where when Lil' Kim, who's like the queen of my life, but I remember when Lil' Kim became a blonde, and all of a sudden all the girls I knew, or my sister was blonde, every girl around me was blonde. Some of my friends were like trying to get their mom to get them blonde highlights. I eventually, like in seventh grade, convinced someone to give me blonde highlights and like convinced my mom to let me get blonde hair. Uh-huh. And then I remember when it was all about, you know, those long acrylic, yes, nails with the white tips and MAC lip glosses with like darker eyeliner, mm-hmm, or lip liner. And so all of that to say that my conceptions of beauty are that type of glamour that I gleaned from the women around me, mm-hmm, the Black women and girls around me who I just thought were so cool and, yeah, so stylish and so beautiful and constantly seeking to emulate them. So as a child, I essentially mirrored my older sisters and older cousins, right? So I loved a Noxzema. Like, give me Noxzema.
Yes. Just Burn the sensation.
Me. Yeah. So I remember this because it was so intense. So my sister used to wash her face with Dove soap, which was like, it had to be Dove sensitive skin. Uh-huh. And she would like scrub her face with Dove soap and then Noxzema. And then rubbing alcohol.
Oh, rubbing alcohol. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, like the green one.
Remember the green one.
Green minty alcohol.
Yeah, okay.
The girls didn't have, we didn't, yeah, know about toner.
Yeah, but I didn't even, I only say that, like, not in a judgmental way, but I never knew that.
So horrible.
That alcohol, rubbing alcohol was like a thing that.
Yeah.
Oh,
people,
my gosh,
were putting alcohol on their faces.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Okay, continue.
Yes. And then, so she would Dove soap, a Noxzema mask, rubbing alcohol, and then Ambi.
Okay.
Do you remember Ambi fade cream?
Right, right.
And it wasn't that she wanted her skin to be lighter, but just like those spots and hyperpigmentation that you have.
Right.
And
Ambi's still sold in drugstores, I think.
I think Ambi is. I've seen Ambi relatively recently. I think that hydroquinone is having, the active ingredient in Ambi is hydroquinone, and for a while it was considered carcinogenic, so we were all like skirt skirt on hydroquinone, yeah, and Ambi. And then I guess the association of a bleaching cream,
yes,
made people icky. But I remember it specifically used as a spot treatment.
Yeah.
Whatever, like, we can fight over Ambi. Like, I,
right,
I,
no, fully, I'm, yeah, I'm here for Ambi. Like,
yeah,
I don't associate Ambi with bleaching creams.
No, and my, right, mom would put it on her, like, tell me to put it on my elbows, uh-huh, if you feel like your elbows were dark, or, uh-huh, anywhere you felt like you wanted to like fade darker marks or hyperpigmentation. And then she would end it all with like the Oil of Olay moisturizer.
Okay,
so I did that pretty. Like, I was really committed to that beauty routine.
Okay.
And I was really committed to lip gloss. And I remember just the incessant fight over lip gloss, because another thing I've been thinking about recently is the proximity in working class or poorer, at least urban neighborhoods, there's always a beauty supply. There's always, right, a nail shop. There's always a hair salon. So I never felt like beauty or beauty services or something that I had to go very far to attain.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something that you did. You wanted lip gloss, you got up and went to the beauty supply and returned,
right,
with lip gloss, perms, all this other shit.
Right.
And can you curse on here?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Perms, I remember. I always remember regimented beauty in that way. Like,
okay,
our mother or a cousin, if she wasn't available, taking the day to perm our hair or do our hair. And yeah, so I grew up with just an appreciation for and a fascination with beauty. And as I got older, I've honestly never had like problem skin,
mm-hmm,
but in wanting to have perfect skin, I was very, 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 I was in high school 2004 to 2008. It was Kardashian mania,
mm-hmm,
right? So
yeah,
we had YouTube and those girls were drawing faces on their faces,
right,
just,
right,
contour to hell.
Yeah.
So I was very into makeup.
Okay.
And that was my motivation or my interest in aesthetic school was because I wanted to be a makeup artist. And then I went to aesthetic school and it was like, well, I could continue to. And this was also when we didn't have a huge array of foundations and makeup for Black women.
Yes.
I usually could find my shade, but I remember it was always like just my shade. Yeah. Like if you get a hair darker, this is not my shade. Where the buck ends. Right. I remember loving Chanel foundation and it would match me for like 4 months out of the year.
Yeah.
Because like that was the darkest it went. And then everybody's NC45 and MAC. So, but I
am admittedly NC45.
Yeah, me too. So is my mom.
It's an interesting formula, NC45.
Yeah, I feel like it is supposed to. I'm not sure if it's supposed to match everyone or if they just claim that it matches everyone. Yeah. But I know a swath of girls who are like NC45.
Hey.
Yeah. But so I went to beauty school and my makeup habit became a skincare habit because it's like I could buy foundation or I could just take care of my skin and not need foundation and look better. Mm-hmm. So that was what happened. And I've been, I guess, very, quote, into skincare since then.
Yeah.
And
what's your regimen look like now?
My regimen now? So, the cleanser, I love the Kiehl's Creamy Cleanser.
Okay.
But I'm also, so speaking of retrograde or, you know, out of style skincare products, I know that we all hate or we know better than the St. Ives apricot scrub, mm-hmm. but they have a cleansing stick. Like they're trying to reformulate and re-advertise themselves. So they have like a cleansing stick solid that I'm really interested in.
Okay.
So right now I'm using the Kiehl's Creamy Cleanser. I don't really wear makeup every day. I wear like my most heavily used makeup product is definitely concealer and like an eyebrow, eyebrow pencil. But Kiehl's Creamy Cleanser, then I tone with the Biologique Recherche.
That's like the one that it's really
the P50.
Yeah,
the one with like phenol.
But it works. People love it.
Yeah, I really didn't want it to work.
I know. I'm gonna eventually buy it, and it's gonna be over.
Yeah. So I wash with that, then I tone. Serums, I'm really into Arbutin right now. So I use either the Ordinary Arbutin or Alpha Arbutin or Drunk Elephant Vitamin C.
Okay.
And then another serum, usually either hyaluronic acid or lactic acid. Or if I'm not using the other product, then a retinoid, just like a really low percentage retinoid.
I use retinoid.
Well, the brand active retinoid.
Yeah. Well,
I really like it.
Okay. There's the one you just said that's on the Ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But then before I was using that one, I actually had a doctor prescribe me.
Ooh, was it different?
It was like a tretinoin. Tretinoin, yes. And so with that one, you definitely, like, your face starts to peel. Mm. You start to get, like, I know I love it.
Yeah.
You start to definitely break out some because your skin, like, these layers are, you know, you're basically purging your skin. It's resurfacing. And so I love that.
Yeah.
And so I went to Uganda a few weeks ago, and I stopped using it because I was just like, I don't, like, it's going to be hot out there. Like, it's going to be, like, yeah. And so I was like, I'm not going to use it. But now I'm getting back on using my tretinoid. I feel like I didn't use the Ordinary's retinoid long enough to really see the effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
But did it work well for you?
It's probably one of my favorite products from them.
Okay.
It's just instantly like plumping and whatever I'm unhappy with my skin. Like right now I have a mosquito bite on my face. Like a mosquito bit my face. And I felt like the retinoid, it may be in my mind, but I was like, oh, this is helping, maybe.
Do you feel like you can use that retinoid whenever in the day or only at night?
No, you should use it at night because sun exposure and, like,
okay.
It's in the same family as, like, the tretinoin,
okay.
which is, like a vitamin A.
Right.
And your skin is just really sensitive to the sun.
Yeah.
So I use it at night.
I feel like because it's an oil, it kind of like tricks me into thinking
it's like that oily serum.
Yeah. That it's not as aggressive, but I think it kind of, I think it is. I just need to give it more of a chance.
Yeah. I love it. It's one of my favorite products from them. That and the zinc niacinamide.
Yes.
Yeah. The niacinamide's really good.
Once I heard all the crazy stuff about like the founder of The Ordinary.
Oh, Brandon. Yeah. I follow him on Instagram and it's just such a wild ride.
It's such a wild ride.
I feel like I should like hoard the products. It's like there's no way this is gonna like, it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. It's just like you buy these products and then in this cancel culture, right? I'm supposed to be like, oh, I protest.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, I bought these products and they're working for me. Yeah, I'm at least gonna ride them till the wheels fall off.
Yeah. I didn't cancel him.
I didn't either. I still follow. And
he's a good time. When he's not spiraling. Did you see the tweet? Or I love when he like subs his employees.
Yeah, and like his like executive staff.
Yeah, there was
everything
one day,
is fine.
Yeah, there was one day where he was like, "Hi guys, I just want you to know that despite what you think, I do appreciate you and I know I may not act like it." And then another account was like responding to him that was apparently an ordinary associate. And I was like, "Oh,
oh, God.
This is just such a train wreck."
I guess this is how you communicate with your founder. He's not answering his email.
Yes.
So before we end, you know, I told you I always have like a plus one segment on my podcast.
Yeah.
I talk to people, and we've already kind of been doing this, about people, places, things, experiences that they are into right now.
Ooh, something I'm into right now. I haven't stopped by the Sephora VIB sale.
Oh my gosh, it happens once a year?
Mm-hmm.
And it's happening right now?
Yeah. Sephora, little bitch. They gave us like 15%. It used to be 20.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's 15%.
Well, first of all, now I know that it's happening. I don't think I was fully aware that it was happening. And now that I'm here in New York where there's a Sephora on every corner like a Starbucks.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of Sephoras here. And there's that one in Times Square that's open till midnight.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to that one before.
Yeah, I've made like so many just weird manic late nights. Like, I'm going to Sephora right now at 8 o'clock.
Like, I need this right now.
Yeah.
This is self-care. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember something that I bought during the sale last year was the Good Jeans by Sunday Riley. Because I feel like that's such a good purchase to get on sale at Sephora at that point.
I definitely didn't get it. I didn't pay full price for it either. I think it was another sale or something.
That was another product that I wish came actually in like a bigger vial.
Mm-hmm.
It's all capitals and they just want you to buy more and more and more of it.
Yeah.
It comes in a really small.
It is really small.
I'm just like give me like a Costco.
Yeah.
Like size.
A vat of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that's what I'm very tentatively living for right now. Okay. Even though, again, I really, really, I can't make the move to Ulta.
Me either. I think it's a brand thing.
I need luxury. Like,
I need something
Ulta's
that feels
not a luxury experience.
Yeah, to me, that's definitely something. It to me, it's like Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not into Dunkin' Donuts because I don't like the colors. I don't like the brands. I don't like what they're trying to sell me.
Even though like Sephora or Starbucks is only just a hair better than Dunkin' Donuts, but the experience is so much sleeker.
Right. And I am the first one to admit that I value experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
In these days where I'm just trying to.
And Ulta just does not cater to me the way that I need.
No, I feel you. Emergency stop, absolutely. I need a quick lip gloss or a travel size.
Yeah, I went in an Ulta in New York the other day, and I was just like.
No, I feel you.
It's like, just damn it all. But so I guess that's the thing I'm excited about is the Sephora VIP sale and gonna get like a premium, ridiculous item.
You'll have to let me know what it is, quite frankly.
Yeah, I'm really looking at, do you know Tata Harper?
Yes.
Yeah, I used to have the resurfacing mask, and I used it once, and then I got the P50, and it was so amazing. I was like, this shit is going back. It was $75. This is all I need.
Yeah.
So I kind of didn't give it a chance, and now I kind of want the resurfacing. mask again.
To see how it goes.
Yeah.
I think that you should make that your purchase.
Yeah.
I support you and give you permission to do
that. Yeah. I have returns, so we'll get a store credit.
Yes.
Yeah. People think it's like an urban legend, but you actually can be banned from making returns to Sephora.
Really?
Mm-hmm. If you return more than a certain amount of items within, I believe, a 1 year period, they'll cut you off from
returning.
Yeah, like they did it, and you know, it's okay. I have my ways.
I did not know that that was a thing, but I'm glad that you made that. You are bringing more awareness to that.
Returning something tonight.
Jasmine.
Yeah.
I'm ready to talk about my plus one.
Yes.
Only because I'm so excited. I was thinking about this on the way here.
Yes.
And you know what? It's not a new thing, mm-hmm. but I personally, as you see I'm wearing now, am just obsessed with linen. I just feel like I am now kind of realizing the glory of the fabric linen.
Mm-hmm.
The airiness of it, the lightness of it. Ooh, I feel like
I think my pants are linen.
Really?
Yeah.
I think they are too.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I feel like, especially growing up in mm-hmm. black communities, it's like our uncles are wearing linen, all white linen to the cookout. And it's now I'm like, honestly, same. It's
Black
light.
People love linen.
It's airy. It makes me look carefree, even though I'm not.
It looks good on you.
Thank you. And yeah. also, you can pick it up at thrift stores for really cheap Ooh. Because it's like not a. It's like not fully a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get them at thrift stores. Like this is from my friend has like a vintage shop, and she gave me this. I have on right now like a white button up mm-hmm. long sleeve linen rolled up, and she gave this for me for free. Oh. She'll probably sell it on her site for like $50, but it cost her $3, which I don't knock the hustle, Ooh. But I'm just saying that it's becoming popular in that way.
Yes.
And I think it would actually be really cool if someone did an episode on the oral history of linen in the Black community.
Yeah. It really is true. Black people love linen.
Yes.
My mom loves a linen moment.
I even have linen sheets now.
Ooh, what's that like?
It's really, okay, so it's not definitely and certainly not as soft as a cotton,
mm-hmm.
but to me, it kind of if you're someone who like me, I definitely like get hot in bed.
Mm-hmm.
In my duvet cover is linen too. It kind of just like helps to keep you airy and breathable. It's like a breathable sheet.
Yeah.
It's like a little bit of luxury.
Yeah. I'm glad you have that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Jasmine, this was so great.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on and for sharing all of your thoughts.
Yes.
And I feel very proud about adding you to this like repertoire of amazing writers that I've had on this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Pleasure was all mine.
Yes.
Yay.